Welcome to the American Cafe. I'm your host, David Byrd. You might have heard the internet described as a global village. But what if what you see in that village, the news you get, the pages that come up when you search for a topic, doesn't reflect your culture? Well, this week we're chatting with Ramesh Srinivasan, a UCLA educator and author who addresses some of those questions in his new book, Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World.
You can't serve people unless you understand people. You can't make money from people unless you also have a relationship with those people.
That's author Ramesh Srinivasan on this week's American Cafe. The United Nations International Telecommunications Union says that 95% of the world's population lives in an area that is covered by a mobile cellular network. And literally billions of people get their news and information on their mobile phone, either from their Facebook feed, Google News, or other sources. But are we really getting the whole story? Or are we just seeing what the internet providers think we want to see? And how does that affect the growth of our culture and how we understand one another? To find out, I spoke with UCLA professor and author Ramesh Srinivasan. His new book, Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World, addresses some of those questions.
Where do we go when we want to experience the digital world? Well, increasingly, we're going to Facebook and to Google. We're going to Google for all of our search results and, of course, our emails and so on through Gmail. But we're also going to Facebook as a kind of community space, a space where we see, you know, pictures of our friends' babies or we see various posts that people have of their families or of their cats, for example. But all of those are spaces where culture is actually produced, because any experience where we actually access information is actually shaping who we are culturally, right? So the problem, though, is we don't actually understand, as users and as a global public, we don't understand the mechanism by which those sorts of experiences are being formed and shaped. If anything, they are black boxes for us these days. And so as the internet is scaled out and these platforms have become our surrogates for experiencing the internet, the ways those platforms function in terms of how they show you what you may or may not want to see, those are the questions that are left unanswered. And so what we know is that those sorts of algorithms more or less tend to reinforce your existing biases, meaning if I'm in the United States and I want to search for information, as I mentioned in a quartz piece I wrote on the country of Cameroon, I want to search for Cameroon online, I'm going to probably see in my Google results web pages about Cameroon that are coming from the United States. And that's not because Google is anti-Cameroon. It's because it understands the bias of me being in the United States looking at Cameroon. But that's sometimes a problem, because if we truly want to be a global village and want to learn from one another on one another's terms, which is what the internet, you know, sort of like promised to deliver, or I guess we hoped it would be, then it has to be better than that. It has to actually allow us to hear other people's voices as they stand across our differences. And that's not what's happening now. We're being placed into bubbles, not just with our search results, which reinforce our sort of like political and cultural worldviews, but also we're seeing that on Facebook, where the vast majority of content that we see is determined by who our friends are already on Facebook. And we don't necessarily see so many posts from people in parts of the world where we may not have any friends. And that means we're not going to see those parts of the world. We may only see them in our own bubble, from our own terms, rather than from the wider set of voices that exist in our world.
And this is kind of related to what went on in last year's election, because there was a lot of talk, or there's been a lot of talk, about kind of these what they call silos of information, people finding people who reinforce what they already believe. But
right.
In the developing world, you're taking a tack that the mathematics behind that is different in the developing world, because their way of telling stories is different.
Absolutely. That's a really important point, and a really important point in the book. When we think about what a technology is in its ideal moment. It facilitates who we already are, right? Who we already are in our best moments. And so many of our enriching experiences, even today, are about sharing information in ways that are not necessarily about being on platforms that contain information, right? Like, so for example, think about storytelling, which is such an important kind of practice of sharing information across so many different cultures. You know, the ways in which we tell stories may not always work well with the ways in which these technologies are produced and contribute to our experience of one another. So that's why it's so important to remember that in their best moments, technologies serve who we are outside of the world of technology. Technologies are tools, technologies are systems, and they're nothing but mechanisms of facilitating what we want as humans, culturally, politically, economically. And so if we start to substitute those sorts of like fundamental human experiences with sort of some black box technology, and we see that as a surrogate for that which makes us human, then we're losing a great deal. And I argue in the book that we in our world are featuring an incredible loss of diversity, biodiversity, right, in terms of like plants and animals with climate change. But actually, not just that, we're also featuring an incredible loss of cultural and linguistic diversity. There's a vanishing of languages in our world that's happened on a massive level. And associated with that is a kind of more of a homogenizing of culture across the world. And that's really a problem because in those forms of diversity, like different languages, they actually are mechanisms by which we actually are learning about one another. We're actually realizing how the world functions in a very fundamental way through those processes. So it's not good enough for us to sort of filter the world or flatten the world through technology. We have to embrace our differences, and that's the most important thing of all. So I want to think and help us imagine technologies that allow us to speak to one another across our differences, not flatten them.
Now, what, you know, along that line, what can people do? How can they become more informed consumers, as it were, of technology? Because I don't think that, you know, Facebook and Google are going to change the way they do things.
sure.
Well, because they're in it to make money. I mean, they are commercial enterprises. They're not, you know, they have a public service function, but they're in it to make money. And so the more people they can get to click on the ads in your Facebook feed, the more money they make. But how can a person who's on the receiving end of that, particularly when the world is going more and more where people are getting their information from mobile devices like a smartphone or a 3G phone, how can they be an informed consumer and go, well, that's either right or that's wrong?
Absolutely. These companies are private companies, and I understand that. But it's also important to note that they're the face of media. They're also media networks. People go in the United States and actually many parts of the world, they go to Facebook to get news. That's not necessarily like a problem per se, but that means that Facebook is the actually platform of experiencing the wider world. So there is a blurring of the private and the public in terms of how we experience those platforms. So that means it's very important for those platforms to continue to make money, continue to understand that they have shareholders and they have to deliver value for their shareholders. They're doing a great job of that, but they're not doing quite as good a job of actually understanding their public social responsibility. And I believe this is a win-win. I think companies that do exist that understand that they have a public responsibility to explain to us why they retrieve certain search results or why we see information that we see, or what they might be doing with our data. These are all concerns that exist now in the United States and around the world. Those sorts of companies have that public responsibility, and I believe if they do so, people will feel more of an investment in those platforms, that those platforms and those companies care about their users. I do believe that there's a space for a more of a relationship rather than being closed off from the world and sort of basically being the platform that serves the world. You can't serve people unless you understand people. You can't make money from people unless you also have a relationship with those people. And that's what I'm arguing for in this book.
That's Ramesh Srinivasan, the author of Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. So, what do you think? Where do you get your news from? Has it shaped how you see the world? Let us know your thoughts and ask your questions by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA American Cafe. That's also where we'll have links to Dr. Srinivasan's Twitter feed, and we'll also provide you a link where you can find his book if you want to read it. Until next time, I'm David Byrd in Washington. Thanks for listening.